is about the persistence of memory. So this painting is actually called The Disintegration of the Persistence of Memory. And this is based on this paper, which was done in collaboration with Matt Kleban, Alberto Nicolas, and Chris Sigurdsson. And let me explain why this paper has such a long title. So this is the more famous painting, which is called The Persistence of Memory. And before we wrote our paper, there was a paper which is very interesting by Garriga, Guth, and Vilenkin called Eternal Inflation, Bubble Collisions, and the Persistence of Memory. And so when we were working on our follow-up paper, we were very happy to discover the existence of this other painting whose title suited our conclusions. And as long as we're talking about Dalí, I found this quote. For some reason, he wrote something called the Antimatter Manifesto. And in fact, this later painting is about quantum mechanics, at least in his mind. Okay, so let me just mention that what I was thinking about in preparing this talk is to communicate to non-experts the motivations and the context here and the main results. So please feel free to interrupt with a non-expert question if something is confusing. And I'm going to be here all week. So you know, if you're very interested in this and you want to talk about the details, I'll be here all week. And I've already been having a very enjoyable visit here. Okay, so I'll give a rather broad introduction here, and then I'll get to the main question that I'm going to address. So slow roll inflation is usually what people say solves the flatness and horizon problem. I want to ask the question, what was happening before slow roll inflation started? And more to the point, I want to ask whether there are observable consequences of whatever it was that was going on, or however slow roll inflation started. I want to know if we can observe something about that. And incidentally, for the purpose of this talk, slow roll inflation is just a module for solving the flatness and horizon problem. So if you have some other favorite theory, I suspect you can substitute that in. But I'm going to be referring to slow roll inflation. So slow roll inflation is an exponential expansion of the universe as long as the potential energy dominates the energy density. So the metric looks something like this, with this exponential expansion as a function of time, where the Hubble constant is related to the potential energy. This is true as long as the potential energy is not changing too quickly. So the radius of curvature is exponentially large because of this exponential expansion. It's exponential in the number of e-foldings. Of course, what I've written here is a flat metric, but if you assume that inflation starts with something which is not completely flat, the whole purpose is to solve the flatness problem, then you would expect that radius of curvature to get exponentially inflated. And so defining the number of e-foldings to be the Hubble constant times time, the radius of curvature would be of order exponential in the number of e-foldings. And then the number of e-foldings is a polynomial function of the parameters and the potential. For example, if you write down m squared phi squared, which is, say, it's valid over a range delta phi, then the number of e-foldings is set by delta phi squared in Planck units, assuming you get to start inflation with the right initial condition. So really what slow roll inflation does is it takes the log of the flatness and horizon problems. Okay, the number of e-foldings is polynomial in terms of the parameters of the potential, but physical quantities like the radius of curvature of the reheating surface are exponentially large. So it takes the log of the flatness and horizon problems. So the question remains whether we could hope to see some hint of the initial state or whatever was going on before slow roll inflation began. So in order to answer this question, though, we need some kind of theory of initial conditions. We need to know what set of things we might start looking for if slow roll inflation did not go on for too long. And there's not many candidates for a theory of initial conditions. There's the no boundary proposal of Hartle and Hawking. And then, in a sense, in which I'll explain, eternal inflation is an alternative theory of initial conditions, although it doesn't quite answer the same question that the no boundary proposal answers. So the no boundary proposal may turn out to be correct in some way, but at the moment, you know, it's not obviously well-defined. It depends on using Euclidean quantum gravity. Well, Neil has told me that there's actually not a signed ambiguity in the exponent, but there is certainly a variety of opinions about the correct sign in the exponent. and some people have argued that it's in conflict with observation. So it may turn out that some version of the no-boundary proposal will be correct, but at the moment I would say we don't quite know how to put meat on that idea. But what is the alternative? So in a sense, eternal inflation is an alternative. So here's a simple type of eternal inflation, which will be nice to keep in mind for this talk. If you have a metastable false vacuum, and if you start out with the field located in that minimum over at least the curvature radius, then the space will exponentially inflate for the same reason as in slow roll inflation. And on the other hand, the false vacuum decays by a local process, a non-perturbative process, where a bubble of true vacuum forms. This process was described by Coleman and DeLuccia. Because this decay is a non-perturbative process, it tends to be exponentially suppressed. And so the bubbles of true vacuum, once you do form them, they expand into the false vacuum. But the false vacuum gains volume by the exponential expansion faster than it loses volume to decays, if the decay rate is small enough. And so what you have is some sort of picture like this, where you have the false vacuum everywhere here, and then various bubbles of true vacuum forming. Maybe some different types of true vacuum bubbles forming. But this whole space is expanding so that the false vacuum never gets completely consumed by these decays. So starting from generic initial conditions, eternal inflation leads to attractor behavior. What I mean by that is that late time state does not remember the initial conditions. Once things get started inflating, produce an infinite space-time volume, an infinite number of bubbles of every type, and the late-time steady-state behavior does not remember the initial conditions. So the sense in which this is a solution to the initial conditions problem is the idea that instead of focusing on whatever the initial conditions were, all we need to do is describe this attractor behavior, this steady-state behavior of eternal inflation, and that's the right way of thinking about the initial conditions problem. Yes.
So how generic initial conditions and what measure are you using to?
Right.
Assuming there will be initial conditions such that it never got started.
So in the colloquial sense of generic, we can just argue about it. There's a precise sense in which this is true, which is that if you start with there are some initial conditions which will allow eternal inflation to occur. And if you perturb those, there's an open neighborhood where eternal inflation still occurs. Okay, and the technical meaning of generic is that it's true in an open set. And I think that's an unambiguous statement. How generic it is in the colloquial sense, I think it's difficult to answer. That's right. Or maybe in the quantum language you would say, as long as there's non-zero probability for the thing to eternally inflate, then that's the branch of the wave function that we focus on. But I think you could raise questions like this. At the moment, I just want to take the, you know, this is in the introduction. I want to just, but I do think there are interesting questions there. Yes.
So in this open set, can you make sense more precisely of the density of bubbles, how it grows? Or is there any quantitative models for what's happening there?
I just had in mind some kind of theory with a scalar field coupled to gravity or whatever.
Yeah.
But I guess I don't understand your question. I could define the boundaries of that open set, but.
No, I'm just asking you were saying that the space grows, the bubble grows, but the ratio. I'm asking what is the density of, you know, I take a slicing, what is the density of bubbles there compared to the false vacuum?
Yeah, so that's the type of thing that people compute. You can do that semi-classically. You know, assuming that if you make the potential such that there are no Planckian energy densities, then you can do this all within the semi-classical approximation. But I guess you're getting to my next point here, which is that there are ambiguities in characterizing this attractor behavior, basically related to what time slicing you use. So you could just say, here's my initial surface, and I'm just going to use proper time as a variable. Then you get one characterization of this attractor behavior, but if you use a different time variable, you get a different behavior. So at the moment, I'm going to try to avoid these. In this talk, I'm going to avoid these difficulties, but this the right way, the mathematically rigorous way of characterizing this attractor behavior is an interesting question, and it's something that I'm thinking about now. It's something which other people have been thinking about also. But I'm going to try to avoid those ambiguities for right now and just take away, okay, what I'm going to take away is this, for this talk, I'm going to assume that eternal inflation is the answer to the question of what was happening before slow roll inflation began. Okay, so what I'm going to assume is that the field was in the false vacuum, and then it tunneled, and slow roll inflation began inside that bubble of true vacuum. So here we are down here today with some very small vacuum energy of 10 to the minus 120. And here's a period of slow roll inflation. I'm not attached to this particular value of the Hubble constant, but so this is the type of assumption I want to make here. I'm assuming that the false vacuum probably had some vacuum energy that was relatively close to the Planck scale. And a slow roll inflation began by a tunneling event. Yeah, so that we'll get to how much there is. Okay, so just to the basic features, if our slow roll inflation starts by a tunneling event, the picture is basically like this. We have the false vacuum everywhere outside the bubble. We have this domain wall, which I've drawn in red, which separates the false vacuum from the region inside. And then you have some period of ordinary slow roll inflation. Eventually up here, you have reheating and structure formation and so on. So these surfaces here are surfaces of constant field value, of constant scalar field value. And so the symmetries of this problem, this domain wall has constant proper acceleration. So this forms some kind of hyperboloid, or you could call it a three-dimensional de Sitter space, a 2 plus 1 dimensional de Sitter space. And inside here, these are uniform slices of uniform negative curvature, which I've called DH3 here. There are three hyperboloids. And if you want, you can write the metric on them in this way. Okay, so beginning inflation by a tunneling event leads to an infinite open FRW universe. Okay, so it's basically like standard inflation. You just start with negative curvature. And it's a bit funny that this bubble starts out finite, but if you look at the surfaces of constant field, those are actually infinite. And what I've drawn with these lines here, these are the lines which are orthogonal to the constant field surfaces. So if you want, that's the natural rest frame to think about that. That's the corresponds to this time variable here. And eventually, after reheating, when you start to form structures and so on, those structures will be at rest along these time-like geodesics here. And so in mathematical language, the symmetries here are the SO31 symmetry group, which corresponds to boosts around this point. This is a boost invariant configuration here. Everything just depends on the proper distance from that nucleation point of the bubble. So the general question that I want to ask is, what are the observational consequences of living inside a bubble? I already mentioned the negative spatial curvature. Also, the fields are in some particular quantum state. I know that Neil has done some work characterizing this, and several other people who I hope are not here. there are features in the power spectrum at low L. There's various other possibilities, and this is one of the things I'm thinking about now. But a caveat to all of this is that if there are too many E-foldings of slow roll inflation, all of this interesting stuff will get redshifted to wavelengths that are bigger than the visible universe. Okay, the curvature radius will be too large so as to be undetectable, and similarly for these features in the power spectrum. But there's no reason to expect an excessive number of E-foldings. As I said, all slow roll inflation does is to take the log of the flatness problem. It still requires tuning to get extra E foldings. So there's, and I've argued in this paper with Cleveland, Martinez, and Susskind, that you might guess that there's of order 0 to 10 additional E foldings beyond what's already required by observation. But this is, again, a question where it's hard to make rigorous statements. But I think it's reasonable to consider a situation where the number of E foldings is not too large and ask about what we might hope to observe. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on a distinctive possible signal, which is collisions between these true vacuum bubbles. So naively, bubble nucleation is a non-perturbative process. And if we're in the eternally inflating regime, the bubbles don't percolate. And so collisions are rare. On the other hand, Guth and Weinberg showed back in the 80s that every bubble collides with an infinite number of other bubbles. But the question that I'm asking has a finite answer, which is how many bubbles do we expect in our backward light cone that are potentially observable to us? And then if we expect at least one, we can go on in more detail to ask about whether in practice we can observe this collision. So to go back to this picture, if you imagine that this blue bubble is the bubble where our universe is going to form inside of, then there most other bubble nucleations do not collide with us. But from time to time, as this true vacuum bubble gets infinitely large, another true vacuum bubble will nucleate nearby, and those will collide with us. Okay, they have to. There's a horizon size because this is the Sitter space, and they have to nucleate within one horizon radius in order to be able to collide. But there's still an infinite number of those things. But the number inside our backward light cone will be finite. So here's the basic outline. First, I'm just going to briefly describe a little more about what these bubble collisions look like. Then I'm going to review the paper I referred to by Garriga, Guth, and Belenkin. Then I'll present our more general analysis of this question. I'm going to find that the number of bubbles we should expect in our backward light cone is this quantity. It's the decay rate times the ratio of the vacuum energy outside in the false vacuum over the inflationary vacuum energy. And just to be clear, so this is the main formula to remember here. This gamma is the dimensionless decay rate. So it's the decay rate per Hubble 4 volume of the false vacuum. Okay, it's the thing which has to be less than 1 in order for eternal inflation to occur. And I'm going to argue that we should expect this number to be bigger than 1. But reasonable people may disagree at that point. Then I'll talk very briefly about the observability and the effect of how many E-foldings of slow roll inflation there are. So if delta N is the number of E-foldings of slow roll inflation beyond what's observationally required today, the number of easily visible bubble collisions gets exponentially suppressed, like e to the minus delta N. Okay, so if there are too many E-foldings of slow roll inflation, then you won't have a chance to observe these, even though they will be in our backward light cone. And then I'll talk about a number of interesting future directions here. So let me just ask at this point whether there are questions about the assumptions that I'm making or the basic setup here.
You're going to tell us what the signature of collision is.
Okay, I'll tell you very, yes, but not in extreme detail, but yes. I will tell you. So let me mention that there's some related work here, and I'm not going to take great care to describe what was done by who, but there were interesting papers by these authors here, Aguirre, Johnson, Schomer, DeSander, by Dahlin, and by Chang, Cleveland, and Levy. Okay, so here's a picture of a bubble collision. And let me mention right now that these domain walls have constant proper acceleration, so they asymptotically approach the speed of light.
And I'm also going to just draw them as null surfaces. So I'm going to draw these domain walls as light cones. So what this is supposed to be is a top view of the collision between two light cones. So you can imagine that perhaps this red region is the bubble which was going to become our universe. It collides with this green one. The collision occurs along, so this is the collision of two cones. They collide along a space-like surface, which is a two-dimensional hyperboloid. Okay, and then what this purple cone is if we're up here looking back, looking down on it, we see a piece of the collision. You can see that this collision affects a piece of our sky. So we're up here looking down, and if we look over in this direction, we don't see any collision. And if we look over in this direction, we see this collision surface. I think this is going to be a little clearer in the side view of the collision. Okay. So again here, imagine that this is our, that eventually we form up here. We're looking back. Okay, when we look over here, we don't see the collision. When we look over here, we do see the collision. So this collision affects a disk on the sky. And so what you would expect is, say, small changes in the temperature inside a disk on the sky with some non-trivial profile as a function of the distance from the center of that disk. And this has been analyzed to some extent by Chang, Kleban, and Levy, but there's a lot more to be done in analyzing in detail the observational signatures here. What I'm going to focus on here is just mainly I'm describing the distribution of collisions and computing the total number, because before we did this work, everyone had either zero or an infinite number of collisions. So it's important to have a finite number before you can start to look for observational consequences. Okay, so let me describe now what these authors did, and then I'll describe how we extended their work. So in analyzing the decay of the false vacuum, you need to specify some initial conditions. So at the semi-classical level, what the obvious thing to do is to choose a space-like surface on which the field is completely in the false vacuum. Now, you could try to do something fancier, talking about a quantum superposition, but because we're talking about macroscopic regions here, a different vector, decoherence will occur. And so I think that actually the semi-classical picture is going to persist in practice, even if you define in principle some quantum superposition of different surfaces. But here, let me stick to the semi-classical level and just choose a space-like surface, or that's what these authors did, choose a space-like surface on which the field is completely in the false vacuum. So what Garriga, Guth, and Vilenkin did is they used the flat slicing of the Sitter space. So this is exterior here, is the Sitter space. They used the flat slicing where the metric just looks like this, and they chose the surface t equals minus infinity, so the infinite past of the Sitter space. Now, you can convince yourself, we can talk about it, the details of the choice are not actually important to the results. But this choice has two reasonable properties. So first of all, if our bubble nucleates at some finite time, remember these are coordinates in the exterior false vacuum where our bubble is going to nucleate. If we nucleate at a finite time, then we nucleated an infinite time after this initial condition surface. So this is implementing this idea that eternal inflation should be forgetting about the initial conditions, and everything interesting should happen an infinite time after the initial condition surface. The other thing that's reasonable here is that only the expanding half of the Sitter space is included. What I mean by that is that if you draw the full conformal diagram for the Sitter space, there's if you draw it in the embedding coordinates, it looks like this. It's a hyperboloid, which has a contracting part, an expanding part. That's the full geodesically continued symmetric De Sitter solution. But the physical part, which we want to focus on in eternal inflation, is the expanding part. So we're always going to focus on a situation where we're only analyzing the expanding part of De Sitter space. Good. So now let's consider some observers who form inside a bubble here. And let's ask how many collisions are in their backward light cone.
So GGV used the approximation that the space-time inside the bubble is the same as it would have been if the bubble was not there. That's an important assumption which we're going to improve upon. But for the moment, let me summarize their results. So as a result, this isn't very realistic, and I shouldn't really talk about observers. But let's just ask this observer in quotes at the center, how many bubble collisions can you expect in the past there? So by assumption, our bubble nucleates in the false vacuum. So there can't have been any nucleation events to the past of the nucleation point. That leaves this region out here, which is to the future of this initial condition surface, but it's in the backward light cone eventually of this observer here. And so there are going to be a lot of conformal diagrams in this talk. This is convenient because we're asking about what's in the backward light cone, and in conformal diagrams, the light rays are drawn as 45-degree lines. And the thing to keep in mind is that the metric is non-trivial in these conformal diagrams. The metric diverges down here and up here at future infinity, while it's order one in false vacuum Hubble units in the center of the diagram. So if you draw some stupid shape like this, the four volume of that region is order one in false vacuum Hubble units. And so remember that this gamma was defined as the decay rate per Hubble volume. And so the number of the number of bubbles which might nucleate here and collide is of order gamma, the dimensionless decay rate of the false vacuum, which by assumption is significantly less than one. So this guy should not expect to see any collisions in the backward light cone. Now, on the other hand, as I was mentioning, if you ignore the bubble collisions, each bubble contains an infinite open FRW universe. So there was no reason I had to focus on this observer, in quotes, at the center. I could have focused on any of these other ones that would have formed anywhere along these surfaces. Before we think about collisions, there's nothing to distinguish these different observers from each other. In fact, let me focus on a geodesic which is highly boosted relative to the original one. And let's see, what picture do I have here? Yeah. So now I'm going to perform a boost on this to move this guy back to the center. And the effect of that is going to be to change this initial condition surface. Okay? So if you want, it's putting in this initial condition surface, which is breaking the symmetry of the sitter space, which is breaking the symmetry inside the, which relates different observers to each other. So here I've done it. I boosted this observer. Now the observer is at the center, but this initial condition surface has moved over to the side. And now you can see that this observer sees something very strange, which is that all of the bubble collisions come from one particular side. Actually, you should think about this in more dimensions. So this is a cone here, but this is actually a plane. So really, there's one particular direction that the collisions cannot come from, and then they can come from all of the other directions. Furthermore, if you compute it, this four volume here. Yeah, sorry, let me just clarify that last point. So this is a 1+1 dimensional picture. So we can just think in 1+1 dimensions and say all the collisions are coming from the right. If you want the higher dimensional generalization, you should make our universe here a surface of revolution, but this initial condition surface should be a plane. Okay. So if you compute this volume here, you in fact find that it's infinite. So for this highly boosted observer relative to the special one, the number of expected collisions goes to infinity. And just to clarify what picked out this special guy at the center who saw very few collisions, it's that he's at rest relative to this initial condition surface. Okay, there's a geodesic which goes right through here and up into there. That's what picks out the special observer. So the distribution of collisions is the number, depends on where we're living inside this open FRW universe. And the distribution is anisotropic for large boosts, even though we made our bubble nucleate an infinite amount of time after the initial condition surface. Okay? So this is what Garriga, Guth, and Vilenkin called the persistence of memory. For this particular question, eternal inflation did not do a good job of erasing the initial conditions. So the bottom line here is that because the symmetry is broken, which relates the different observers on the spatial slices to each other, predictions depend on where we're living relative to this preferred zero boost geodesic. And so we need some additional theory to predict where we're living in order to predict the number of collisions we might hope to see. That's going to get us into this whole morass of measures and so on, which I think is a very interesting question. It's just part of a larger problem of regulating the infinities of eternal inflation. What I'm going to do here, though, is I'm going to avoid getting into that morass. So I'm going to find that with some assumptions, we actually have a rather robust answer, which does not depend on where we're living. So it's in principle, we need some additional theory. As a practical matter, for the question that I'm going to be addressing, we can avoid getting into complications, and we'll have a robust prediction for the number. In order to get this prediction, though, we're going to have to be a little bit more realistic than the analysis of GGV. So what we're going to need is we're going to need some kind of model for what happens in the future light cone of collisions, including allowing for a realistic cosmology inside the bubble. Because after all, I am really focused on an observational question here. And to be clear, I'm going to focus on this conditional question, which is, in regions where structure formation is not disrupted, what is the predicted distribution of bubble collisions there? Okay? So, yes.
Why isn't the persistence of memory just called a failure of inflation?
Well, I mean, whether or not it's a failure depends on the point is that depending on how you characterize the steady state behavior, it does forget about the initial conditions. It's just that for this particular question, if you want, this is an unnatural time slicing for eternal inflation, where we focus on an entire infinite slice here, and we forget about all the other bubbles that are going out there.
On the other hand, we've given inflation the best possible chance by assuming absolute homogeneity of an infinite universe before it started.
Well, let me make a statement that perhaps we agree on. So before you've understood really what's the right way to regulate eternal inflation, you can't really answer the question of whether eternal inflation forgets the initial conditions or not. Mm-hmm. It's a regulator-dependent question. Yeah.
Let me just see if I'm following. So there's a surface which defines the initial conditions for eternal inflation, which is, which we don't have much observable access to.
Right.
And this defines a frame of reference in our present bubble, assuming the scenario is right.
That's right.
And the question is that frame of reference the same as the cosmological frame of reference defined by the FRW expansion?
That's right.
And you're saying if you assume that it is, then the prediction is less than one bubble in our backward light cone, but there's no reason to assume that it is. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
To which, why isn't a possible answer, which must have been given, of course it is. What else would it be?
Well, the point is that...
Or let me put it less provocatively. Would there, if these two cosmological frames of reference are very different, would there be any other observational consequence?
Yes, that's a good question, and there may well be. It's not totally clear, though. I can't tell you one which would definitely survive the test of this infinite amount of time here. But the reason these frames can't be the same, they can't just be assumed to be the same, mm-hmm. is that, so here's our surface. Let me not draw this as a conformal diagram. So there's some surface in here where reheating happens. And the point is that so this is these are the different frames locally. And only one of those is related to the preferred frame that comes from these initial conditions. So just by locally making this open universe, you have locally a lot of different cosmological frames, only one of which can agree with this frame set by the initial condition.
Oh, because the curvature is negative.
Exactly.
It's that little bit of negative curvature.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And for this question, it actually doesn't matter how much slow roll inflation there is. Mm-hmm. You just go out to enough curvature radii, and you start to see that these frames differ from each other. So yeah, maybe I can draw another. So let's see, here's another. This thing is also at rest in this frame picked up by the initial conditions, but it's boosted relative to the frame picked up by the bubble nucleation. Okay, so I'm going to focus on this. So I'm going to put in the fact that these collisions can disrupt inflation and disrupt structure formation. And then I'm going to ask a conditional question, which is, in regions where structure formation is not disrupted, where we might be living, what is the predicted distribution of bubble collisions? And I'm going to find a robust answer to that question. Okay. Let's see. I guess I won't skip this part. So
let me just mention that you can write a model. You know, this is the sitter space and conformal diagrams and so on. You can write a model for this just in flat Minkowski space, if you trust me a little bit, which has many of the features. Let's take this initial condition surface to be a light cone. And now, in order to make this model work, I'm going to need our bubble to nucleate one Hubble time after this initial condition surface. Okay. Now, the Hubble time doesn't mean anything. We're in Minkowski space. You put that in by hand in order to make this model give the same answers. And then the time when we're living within this UDV analysis is also set by, well, the size of our backward light cone, you should also take to be set by this being one Hubble time here. So you can see that there's some finite green region for this preferred observer at the center, which is set by the Hubble volume, because I've told you that these distances should be set by the Hubble distance. And by the way, the thing that this model gets wrong is that the four volume of this blue region here is finite, whereas in the sitter space it's infinite, and this time is finite. But it gets the volume of these regions available for bubble nucleations right. So now let's ask about the boosted observer. So for the boosted observer, this tip of the light cone gets boosted along over to there, and you can see that there's a lot more volume available to one side than on the other, and that also this volume gets large. Okay, so that's basically what's going on. The sitter space is making these distances effectively finite. Okay, so now let me go on to our analysis here. So I'm going to calculate the probability. What I'm going to do here is first I'm going to calculate the probability distribution for bubble collisions in our backward light cone. And from the beginning, I'm going to put in a realistic cosmology, which is going to involve the space-time geometry inside is going to be different from outside. That's crucial. I'm going to put that in from the beginning, and then I'm going to gradually add in the additional effects I need, the disruptive effects of the collision, and also the initial condition surface. So at the moment, I just have our bubble nucleating here in the sitter space. And because the Hubble constant gets smaller inside, the horizon size gets bigger. And so that's why this future infinity curves up here. We get to look back and see more of our domain wall than we otherwise would have been able to see if the cosmological constant did not change. But you can see that this green region where collision bubbles can nucleate is extremely infinite at the moment. It has all these infinities down here. This blue region, again, you can forget about because we're assuming that our bubble nucleates in the false vacuum. Now, any initial condition surface, I'm not putting in a specific one yet, but any initial condition surface which keeps only the expanding part of the sitter space is going to eliminate these black regions here. So now things are not quite as infinite as they used to be, but there's still divergences in this four volume coming from down here. And those correspond to bubbles which nucleate very long in the past, which can come and collide with our bubble at very early time. Now, a particular initial condition surface will also, for example, the one we were drawing before looks like this. And I'll come back to analyzing the effect of a particular initial condition surface. But they will all eliminate these black regions over here. Right. So would you like this to end at 1, or would you like to see the equations? It'll probably require like an extra 10 minutes to have the equations. Okay. What? Oh, yeah, sorry. 1 is certainly not possible.
1 is not possible.
Okay. So here the coordinate system, which covers the region where the collision bubbles can nucleate. And it's going to be convenient to have this over here for reference. Okay, so here's our bubble. Inside there's some cosmology going on. And then here, this is the shape of the region where the bubbles can nucleate. And then we have some additional false facts on that side here. Remember, this is the black region here. Okay. And then here's going to be our future life form looking back. Okay. So a nice coordinate system which covers this region out here. Remember that these domain walls were lower dimensional de Sitter spaces. And remember this problem has SO31 symmetry. So the nice coordinates to use make that symmetry manifest. And so a coordinate system looks like this. This x tells you, so the x coordinate will move you from minus infinity being at the nucleation point to plus infinity being all the way over here. And x indexes which of these de Sitter spaces you're on. Now, choosing some coordinates on this de Sitter space, we can write the metric like this. So the metric outside here, I wouldn't take you through this, except that it turns out that you can actually write down the distribution of bubble collisions very simply once you write this down, as we discovered after deriving it in every difficult coordinate system first. And there's a two-sphere symmetry in this problem. So now I've just chosen tau to be a coordinate, a time coordinate on these lower dimensional de Sitter spaces here. Okay? So that's the metric outside. And now, good. So then the probability to nucleate a bubble in an infinitesimal region is proportional to the pore volume. Turns out that this dimensionless decay rate is proportional to the pore volume in Hubble units. Okay, and so you can compute the determinant of this metric, and you find something like this. Okay, and the reason I'm saying this is naive is because we haven't yet taken into account the bubble collisions and this initial condition surface, but this is a starting point for the distribution of bubble collisions. Okay, this omega 2 is the direction that this bubble comes from. This x is the thing which controls the intrinsic properties of the collision. By the symmetries of the problem, you can move any point on one of these lower dimensional de Sitter spaces into any other point. So those collisions are physically equivalent, whereas collisions with different x have, for example, different center of mass energy density at the collision, and a different radius of curvature of the collision surface. So there's the distribution of the bubbles. I'm going to put it in some nicer coordinates, though, for looking at it. In order to do that, I want to relate it to observable quantities inside here. And remember that this is an open universe here. It's very useful to use conformal time. And remember, it has these infinite open slices here. So eta is moving us up this way, and rho is moving us out along this slice. And now I'm going to choose to put the observer that we're interested in right at the center here at rho equals 0. I can do that because I haven't yet specified where my initial condition surface is, and I'm going to need to move that around later. So the metric inside here, I'm just going to keep a general scale factor here. And so it looks like this. Okay? And this is just the metric of the constant negative curvature surface. And
I'm going to choose my conventions for the conformal time so that this time here is going to be eta equals zero. The time when, which would have been future infinity if the cosmological constant hadn't changed. That's going to be, which is a proper time of order set by the Pulse Spectrum Hubble constant. That's going to be eta equals zero. Okay? All right. And now I would like to label these collision bubbles by x, which controls the intrinsic properties of the collision. And then rather than using this tau variable, I want to label them by the time when the bubble first becomes visible. So if you have some bubble which nucleates over here, there's a time when it first crosses, when it first comes into the backward light cone of an observer at rho equals zero, or I should say when it first crosses rho equals zero, and that time I'm going to call eta v. Okay, it's the conformal time where this thing becomes visible. Now, of course, you shouldn't think about, so here's a bubble nucleation, you shouldn't think about observers living at this very early time, but following this world line, it first enters the forward light cone of this collision at the time eta v. Now, in this metric, these light cones are just radial null geodesics, and so outside they satisfy x plus tau equals constant, and then inside they satisfy eta plus rho equals constant. And so you can see that the time at which this thing becomes visible, the conformal time, is just given by x plus tau, because that's when it gets to rho equals zero. So making that change of variables, you can write the distribution like this. Okay, there's still a distribution over where these bubbles come from. There's a Koch squared now of this difference. And then there's, again, the spectrum denominator. Now, for the questions we're interested in, we're not going to be too concerned about things like the center of mass collision energy. We're going to be interested in just counting the numbers. So let's integrate out this x variable. And then you get a distribution that looks like this. Okay? We still have an integral over where this bubble comes from. And we have an integral over the time when it first becomes visible. And you can see that there's a divergence here. If you started to integrate this, there's a divergence when eta goes to minus infinity. That's down here. That's from these very early time bubbles. Okay? There's a divergence from these very early time bubbles. And then there's a potential divergence from late time if eta v would go to plus infinity. But that's cut off because of the cosmological constant today. And actually, it's more controlled by the cosmological constant during inflation. And it turns out that eta today is some finite thing, which is related, which is approximately given by the ratio of the Hubble constant in the false vacuum to the Hubble constant during slow roll inflation. And so that late time divergence is cut off just because our horizon size is finite. But we need more physics to cut off this early time divergence here. So I'm going to make a crude model for what happens in the future of a bubble collision here. Suppressing these, remember that this collision has this H2 symmetry, this SO21 symmetry. I'm going to suppress those directions and draw it as a 1 plus 1 dimensional problem. So in the future of some collision, you have a domain wall. And now this green surface is where reheating would have happened. We would have had an infinite open FRW universe. Now, really, the whole future light cone of this collision is up for grabs. What I'm going to assume here is that this domain wall accelerates away from our bubble. Then you might think that over here, the collision has a small effect, whereas over here, the collision has a large effect and completely disrupts inflation and structure formation and so on. Okay, I'm going to be a little more specific about this. So here are the assumptions. I'm focusing on collisions with bubbles which are different from our own so that there's a domain wall which separates us after the collision. I'm going to assume that that domain wall accelerates away from our bubble. And I'm going to assume that observer formation is disrupted in some part of the future light cone, but not all of it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's model dependent. So if we collide with a bubble which has higher vacuum energy, then the wall is guaranteed to run away from us because we're the true vacuum. If we collide with a wall which has lower vacuum energy than our own, say negative vacuum energy, then it depends on the tension of the wall. If the tension is small, then the intuitive thing happens, which is that the vacuum heats us up. If the tension is large, you have these solutions where the tension actually dominates and the domain wall looks like it's accelerating away from both sides. So that can happen as well. So if you put all those things together, you'll see there's a 75% chance that the domain wall will accelerate away from our bubble. Well, but I'm going to focus on regions where we are. So a different way of saying it is, there's collisions you have a chance to observe and collisions you don't. If the domain wall accelerates towards us for that particular collision type, then essentially no observers form in the future of that collision. And we can just forget about that, trying to observe that kind of collision. Now, there's other types of collisions where the domain wall accelerates away. There we have a chance to observe that. Well, you can analyze that question. And the answer is basically the probability of, I mean, if you pick a generic point, the probability of surviving those collisions is zero. But then there's an infinite number of points like that, and you can actually do this math, and you find that there's still an infinite volume of places where a structure does form. We could talk about that, though. But I didn't make it sound particularly well-defined, but I think it is a well-defined question with this initial condition surface. Okay, so to be a little more specific here, it's natural to assume that all the energy scales in the problem are high near the Planck scale, except the inflationary vacuum energy, which we know is somewhat separated from the Planck scale, something like 10 to the minus 12 at least. Because we haven't detected gravitational waves coming from slow roll inflation. So in the case that, so I'm going to assume that the vacuum energy here is high, the tension of the domain wall is high. All of these are separate, set by some high scale, which is relatively close to the Planck scale. Then the characteristic time when this domain wall starts accelerating away from us is set by that scale, which is the same as the false vacuum Hubble constant. So I assume there's just one high scale here. But this is not the crucial approximation here, so don't worry about it. We can talk about it if you're concerned. And then I'm going to assume that inflation is disrupted in this region near the domain wall, but that it's not disrupted over here. And so basically what this means is that if I now put the world line where we'll eventually form on at the center here, collisions with these early time bubbles are very disruptive. This domain wall comes and it runs over our world line, and I'm going to assume that that structure formation is disrupted there. And so these early time bubbles are very disruptive, and they're not consistent with the condition that structure formation formed there. On the other hand, collisions with small bubbles, now big and small are only defined once I've chosen this observer, but that's what I'm doing. Collisions with small bubbles, on the other hand, are boosted away from us. So these are a small effect. So here we don't ever get very close to the domain wall, and structure can form there, and we can hope to see those types of collisions. So here's the caricature. The caricature is that the domain wall moves in for a time set by the false vacuum Hubble constant, then it moves out, and every geodesic which gets run over by the domain wall, structure does not form there. And on the other hand, structure does form along in an unperturbed way. Along geodesics which are not run over by the domain wall. So clearly this is, this crude analysis could be improved upon, but I think you'll see that our conclusions are robust. But let me emphasize again that it's crucial that this domain wall accelerates away from the bubble. I guess you guys have already emphasized that for me. So now what this means, remember I said that these early time, these collisions with large bubbles are very disruptive. So now there's a red region where collision bubbles could nucleate, but it would be inconsistent with eventually forming structure along this world line. Okay? That's that's marked by this red region. Now, the details of this red region are, of course, dependent on this caricature. And clearly, there should be some transition region in between here, where the collision is not a small effect, but it's also not fatal to observer formation. What is very robust is that these regions down here that were providing the divergences, these very early time, very large bubbles, it's very robust that those things are destructive to trying to form structure in an unperturbed way along that world line. Okay? And with my particular choice of, with my particular caricature of the domain wall, what this means is that because this domain wall accelerates in for the Hubble time, what that means is that it accelerates in until the time eta equals zero. Okay? Eta equals zero corresponds to a time equal set by the false vacuum Hubble constant. That was my choice of conventions here. That's this time here. And that means that bubbles which enter the backward light cone before the time eta v equals zero, but before the time, the conformal time zero, are forbidden by this criterion. Okay. So now the distribution looks like this, and now we can focus on only positive conformal times when these collisions become visible. And this restriction comes from requiring observer formation. Now we can integrate out this x again to find this distribution of bubbles. It looks the same as before. It still has this cosh. But now this is not divergent at all. And so you can compute the total number before some conformal time. And you find it's something which exponentially grows with conformal time here. Okay, and so the number of collisions in our past light cone, so I should say, we haven't yet put in the effects of the initial condition surface. But I'm going to jump ahead and tell you that that's going to be a small effect. And just compute the total number here. And then I'll come back and talk about the effects of the initial condition surface. So to jump ahead, the conformal time today, I'm not going to compute it right now. There's small effects from the curvature. But basically, it's given by the log of Hubble constants. And so you see that this thing was an exponential function. And so what we have is that the number of bubble collisions is basically set. There's an enhancement factor, which is the ratio of Hubble constants, which is basically coming from the fact that our horizon size grew here. And so here's the total number of collisions, okay? It's the dimensionless decay rate times the ratio of Hubble constants. And the quick and dirty way of deriving this is that the size of this two sphere here is set by the horizon size during inflation. When we look back, that's how much of our domain wall that we can see. Okay, it's set by the inflationary Hubble constant. On the other hand, this distance and this distance are set by the false vacuum Hubble constant. And so this green 4 volume is set by the false vacuum, is set by this combination of false vacuum and inflationary Hubble constants. And so then the total number is just the decay rate times, well, so when you put it in terms of dimensionless decay rate, some HFs move around and you get this factor. Okay, so that's the quick and dirty derivation. And let me emphasize that this is finite before we've even put in any initial condition surface. So at the moment, this is independent of where the observer is. It's completely isotropic. And this is the number. Now, is it likely that this number is bigger than 1 so that you would have to actually care about this? So under the assumptions I would make, it's very likely. So if we believe that the false vacuum energy is close to the Planck scale, then this ratio of vacuum energies is at least 10 to the 12th or so. On the other hand, there's no reason that the false vacuum should be particularly long-lived, as far as we know. And there's many possible decay channels in the string theory landscape. So perhaps this decay rate, this dimensionless decay rate, is e to the minus a few. Then you have e to the minus a few times 10 to the 12th times 4 pi over 3, which is bigger than 1. But I admit that this is quite a hand-wavy argument. It would be nice to have some sort of model. And I'm not sure there is a very believable model right now. It would be nice to analyze really what you expect for this quantity. But it's not outlandish to expect that this might be bigger than one. So now, finally, let me come back to the question of of the effects of the initial condition surface. How persistent is the memory here? So remember, this was the green region where bubbles could nucleate. Now I'm going to put in this initial condition surface. Let me first put us at zero boost. Okay, so it's clear that this is going to cut off some region there. Okay, this region here would have been allowed for nucleating bubbles, these two regions here. But now it's not allowed because of the initial conditions. But you can see that this four volume is not getting anywhere near the top or the bottom of the diagram. So it's set by the false vacuum Hubble scale. And so the number of collisions which are allowed by my criteria but forbidden by these initial conditions is of order gamma, the decay rate per false vacuum Hubble scale. Now let's go to infinite boost. Okay, here's to go to the other extreme. Now the initial condition surface looks like this crazy thing. It comes up and touches this cone at one side. And this looks like an enormous effect here. Okay? I should have emphasized that this enhancement in the number of collisions is basically coming from these late bubbles which collide up near here, up near future infinity, where this metric is getting large, okay, near this large true sphere. Now it looks like these are getting cut off. But now you have to remember again that this cone is a surface of revolution, whereas this initial condition surface is a plane. So there's really only one direction where bubbles are forbidden from. And if you do the computation, you find that the number of collisions which are forbidden by the initial conditions, which would have been allowed by the other criteria, has this log enhancement. But again, it's gamma times this log. And so again, that would be less than one for reasonable parameters. And certainly, delta n over n is much less than one. So this distribution is close to being isotropic and independent of boost. So we don't need, for this purpose, a theory which tells us where we're living in this infinite open universe. Okay, so this is what we call the disintegration of the persistence of memory. Okay, any questions about that? I just have a few words to say about the observability and so on, but.
So just to understand logic, if
those very rare inflating bubbles, slowly inflating bubbles, which were not wiped out by the early deluge bubble collisions. So it's completely the opposite story of what the story was a few years ago when there were no collisions. Now, is an infinite number of collisions, but it happened. But if you really believe the whole story, there's also an infinite number of inflating regions, and so there's a finite probability to survive the onslaught. Mm-hmm. And then if you survive the onslaught, then you know that there wasn't one up to a certain point, and then you're able to estimate the number. And given that the collision rate is actually sizable, it's still sizable to have happened at late times, even if not early enough to destroy us.
That's right. We have a bit of enhancement at late times because we get to see multiple Hubble volumes of the false vacuum. And that's what's giving us a chance there. All right, again, there's a lot more to do to look at the observability. The basic way that you should really think about this is something which happened before inflation began. Okay? There's various time slicings you could use here. But this is something which, if structure is going to form here, the signal has to get through 60 E foldings of inflation. So the right way to think about it is a perturbation on the initial conditions for slow roll inflation. And so it's going to be at very long wavelengths. And the best signal is probably to look for effects on the CMB. And as I said, collisions give these disks on the sky. And they've been analyzed by Chen, Kleben, and Levy, but there's more to be done here. Yes. But so the easiest collisions to see influence only part of the last scattering surface. If they influence all of the last scattering surface, then the danger is that they're more or less homogeneous on the sky, and they don't form these nice disks. Okay? So, and I'm not going to go through the physics here, but if you look at the distribution of angular sizes on the last scattering surface, so the angular sizes of these disks. So last scattering surface is a sphere. Let's look at the angular size for the disk, which is affected by the collision. The number, which don't affect the whole thing, but only affect part of it, is related to the curvature today. So we have the total number here, and then we have a small number, which is 8 times the square root of the curvature contribution to omega, which if omega is at its bounds, is order 1. But as you add extra E foldings of inflation, omega k will go down. And this number of disks which affect part of the last scattering surface will get suppressed. Okay, so the number of extra E foldings you can afford depends on how many bubbles you have to start out with. And the distribution of angular sizes at last scattering is a relatively featureless distribution. Okay? So it's kind of funny, these bubble collisions, they eat up a small part of this two sphere here of our backward light cone, but at last scattering they've expanded to eat up order 1 fractions of the sky. Okay, so we just have this boring distribution for angular radius. So let me mention some future directions here. First of all, there's the obvious ones. You know, we should just look for these bubble collisions. They have a quite distinctive signal. And if we're going to do this, I mean, really we need a more detailed analysis of the future of the collision, how it affects inflation, reheating, what's the best signal to look for, how precisely is this going to show up in the CMB. Then more generally, I think there's an interesting question of what are the observational consequences of a tunneling event in our past. I've talked about bubble collisions. I've referred to the negative curvature. But I think really no one has done an exhaustive analysis of what are the possible signals. And how long do they last into slow roll inflation? Then a couple more theoretical questions. Quantum gravity should tell us something about, you know, how to understand the problem of initial conditions or on the attractor behavior of eternal inflation. And really that hasn't happened yet. So there's really room for an advance here if we can apply the ideas of string theory or something to rigorously understand eternal inflation. And an additional interesting theoretical question is how complete is the disintegration of the persistence of memory? I mean, I've argued here that it's, as a practical matter, the memory of the initial condition surface has disintegrated here. In principle, it was still there. And it's an interesting question to ask whether, in some sense, that's removed or whether it could be observable, what the other signals might be. And so I think there's a very interesting set of questions there. Thank you.
We'll break, and Ben is around all week, as you said, so encourage everybody to talk to him. So thanks a lot.